This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of November 6th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Have you read the latest healthcare reform proposal in the House? 1,990 pages. You haven't? Well, you might be able to get through it by the time a bill actually gets through Congress. As the healthcare debate drags on at the national level, we'll look at what one state might do to change the patient experience. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today.
This week, Senate President Harry Reid said there are no guarantees that any health care reform will pass Congress this year. So as we all continue to wait on the national level, states are moving ahead with their own ideas. Massachusetts is considering a surgical repair of its own health care system. Right now, as in most places, it's got a so-called fee-for-service model. Doctors and hospitals are paid for each service they perform. Joel Rose reports on the debate over something called a global payment system.
Don't worry. I'm not going to launch into a discussion of international finance. The global payment I'm talking about refers to the practice of paying doctors a flat fee in advance to cover all of a patient's medical needs.
That encompasses all the costs for their ambulatory care, for their inpatient care, for their medications.
Richard Lopez is chief physician executive for Atrius Health. It's a nonprofit alliance of more than 800 doctors in eastern Massachusetts.
Yes, hi, Florence. This is Jeannie Fitzpatrick calling from Dr. Zamalou's office.
Atrius Health has been using global payment for 20 years. Here's how it works. Say my doctor is part of Atrius. The insurance company pays Atrius at the beginning of the year. The amount depends on my health, which is pretty good, and my age. There's no financial incentive to do extra tests or procedures. On the contrary, says Lopez, my doctor would like to see me as little as necessary.
One of the incentives in global payment is really to keep patients healthy so that it does control costs.
Massachusetts seems to agree. Over the summer, the state's Payment Reform Commission recommended that Massachusetts switch to the global payment model. Judy Ann Bigby is the state's Health and Human Services Secretary.
Right now, we have a lot of waste in the system because 20 to 30% of the services that people get may not be necessary.
The hope is that global payment will reduce unnecessary tests and procedures, but some doctors are worried about the unintended consequences.
That was tried last time and everyone rebelled, not just physicians, payers, patients, and that's a failed model.
This is Mario Mata, president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. And the failed model he's talking about is known as capitation. It was a flat fee system that was common back in the 1980s and 90s. Mata says many doctors in private practice hated the system.
Basically, they were given one lump sum of money to manage all their patients. Well, what if you have a few patients who have extraordinarily high expenses? That would bankrupt that practice.
And Mata says patients didn't like the system either because they felt they were denied expensive tests and treatments. Healthcare providers say they've learned some important lessons from the past.
Things have changed since the last round of managed care. There are ways to monitor and see that care is not being withheld for simply financial reasons.
Lynn Nicholas runs the Massachusetts Hospital Association. She says electronic records will make it easier to measure medical outcomes and to coordinate patient care. But she says it's also crucial that doctors and hospitals don't wind up shouldering too much of the financial risk, as they did back in the 90s.
The margins are so thin that if they really mess this up, either through poor management or through poor design, they'd go under. There's no other alternative.
To spread the risk, the Massachusetts plan would pull doctors and hospitals together into large groups. This may all sound reminiscent of the dreaded HMOs of the 1990s, but the state's HHS Secretary Judy Ann Bigby says patients don't need to worry.
For people who use a lot of medical care, hopefully they will find that their care is more coordinated, that providers are talking to each other, that they're working together to deliver the best care to people.
Lawmakers still have to decide how and when Massachusetts will switch to global payment. No state has tried this before, but if it works, Massachusetts probably won't be the last. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace Money.
So you really didn't think banks would just twiddle their thumbs until the new credit rules took effect next February, did you? No, they've used that time to the fullest. They've hiked interest rates, cut credit lines, and imposed all kinds of new fees on cards. So what can you do aside from cutting up all those cards and living on cash? Which isn't a bad idea. Well, here with some answers is Ken Lin. He's CEO of the website CreditKarma.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is the best advice to folks who are trying to navigate their credit cards, whether they want to cancel cards, get new ones? What should they be looking for over the next 6 months?
Generally speaking, definitely don't cancel credit cards. Credit cards are a great way to build your credit history and your breadth of credit products. So you don't want to cancel your cards. What you want to do is you want to really focus in on the two or three credit cards that have a low interest rate and no annual fees. And then what you want to do is you want to keep those credit cards active. So you want to buy a tank of gas or buy some groceries with them once every couple of months, because what credit card companies do is they look at people who are inactive and who are essentially costing them money. And in those situations, they might close those cards down. You don't have to carry a balance or pay interest to keep them active. You just need to go and spend, you know, once a month or once every other month.
When folks are debating whether to cancel their cards, I mean, you've basically just said that you shouldn't be canceling your cards, but then you're hanging on to cards that perhaps do have an annual fee or, you know, some other thing. How do you weigh whether to cancel that card or keep it around just because it's going to affect your credit score if you don't?
I think what you just mentioned is the one exception that I suggest, which is if you have a card that has an annual fee, then don't keep it just for the sake of keeping your credit score high. Don't pay to have a good credit score, i.e. don't pay interest if you don't have to. Don't pay annual fees if you don't have to. But if you have a card that doesn't have an annual fee, that has, you know, a decent credit limit, and you know that you're not tempted to spend on it needlessly, that's a good thing for your credit score because it shows that you are responsible. It shows that you don't go out and, you know, spend beyond your means. So in those scenarios, don't close them down proactively.
Is it possible to find low-interest, no-fee cards anymore?
They're becoming harder to find. But, you know, if you have good credit, it's still possible. You just have to be very diligent about looking for the right cards. And when you're looking for the right cards, it's also really important to find the right card that's commensurate with your credit score. I think a lot of consumers get into trouble when they apply for credit cards that are outside their range. One, you're going to get declined, but more importantly, you're going to get a credit inquiry, which will lower your credit score, which is going to hurt you when you find the right card that you're looking for. So it's important to kind of match your credit level with the credit card that you're applying for.
What about if you're carrying a balance and you're watching as credit card companies get ready to make these changes? What do you do?
Well, I think there are some credit card companies out there that will still try to do the right thing for the consumer. In some cases, your local bank or the bank that you do most of your checking and savings with, they may actually have promotional programs that will help you defer that balance or at least help you get a good rate on that particular balance. Banks are still trying to make money the old-fashioned way by lending consumers money. And some of them will have promotional programs, but they're just fewer and far between. So I think consumers just have to do more research.
And that's really only if you have a high credit score, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's really a fundamental thing that we need to stress is that gone are the days of lax credit requirements. All of the offers and all the great rewards and benefits that we historically talk about and the conveniences of credit cards, that's going to become a luxury for the high credit end market. And for people on the margin, it's going to be very difficult. Rates are going to go up and they're going to have many fewer options.
Ken Lin is the founder and CEO of the website CreditKarma.com. Thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com. By Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This coming week marks Veterans Day, so we thought we'd take a moment to look at the new GI Bill that took effect this summer. It brings the benefits more in line with current costs for tuition and books and housing. So far, more than 200,000 people have signed up, and that is causing a big backlog for applications. David Siegel is a sociology professor at the University of Maryland who studies military organization. He says the new GI Bill has been a victim of its own popularity.
There was not much lead time between the passage of the bill and the opening of school for the fall semester. It was clear that the Veterans Administration was not going to be in a position to deal with all of their applications before the fall semester began.
The new bill pays tuition directly to schools, but because of the backlog, schools weren't getting the checks, so vets weren't getting the okay to start class. Sergeant Richard Smith was one of them. He joined the Army in 2003 right out of high school.
I had dreams of going to a good school, but apparently when you skip a bunch of school to go surfing, it doesn't work out so well, so I chose to join the Army.
Smith started at the University of Alabama last year under the old GI Bill, meaning he had to take out loans, so he was thrilled that the new bill meant his tuition and housing were paid for. Many schools are floating veterans' costs while the system catches up, but Smith had to front his tuition out of pocket.
Honestly, it was kind of a big problem. I had, you know, like $106 in my checking account, and my rent was coming due.
The VA has issued emergency $3,000 checks to help GI students pay bills. Smith was about to drive several hours to get one of those checks when his tuition payment finally arrived. Another service member, Lieutenant Eric Petrovich, has spent much of the last 20 years in the Armed Forces and Reserves. He now lives in New Jersey. He says the old model of the GI Bill was to go to school after service. But many soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are enrolling while deployed. And the new bill makes that easier.
You pretty much either work out in a gym, you go to school online, or you hang out and play video games. So a lot of people end up start going into classes just because there's nothing else really to do. And they really begin to enjoy the whole aspect of learning and doing missions. If there's a long drive between, you know, here and their objective, might be studying, might be taking notes while that vehicle is moving en route.
Petrovich isn't eligible for the new GI Bill since he's got a master's on the old one. But the new benefit can be transferred to a spouse or child. And Professor David Siegel says that changes the motivation for military service.
Just as educational benefits were incentive for joining the service, they were an incentive for leaving once the benefit had been earned. It's a tremendous advantage to pass them on, and that's a reason for staying in the service rather than leaving.
Professor David Siegel speaking about the new GI Bill as we mark Veterans Day. If you think paying the bills is something tedious you do after the kids are in bed, why not make it a family activity?
I think parents just forget, you know, everything I do is a teaching opportunity for my own children.
We'll have that and more lessons from a high school economics teacher coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. In many ways, the subject of money seems to be even more of a hot potato than sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Think about it. What did you say the last time your kid asked you how much money you make? And why did you think to yourself, none of your business, before you said, oh, Sally, all that matters is that we can support our family? Well, because this conversation tends to be avoided in many homes, schools are left to pick up the slack. More and more kids are given a choice of whether to learn personal finance. It is not deemed as essential as reading, writing, and arithmetic, even though it's all about arithmetic. Youth Radio's David Dominguez talks about the educational choice he made.
It seemed dumb to take a class that taught you how to live. Well, now I know. See, in ninth grade, I transferred from a public high school to a charter school in Los Angeles. So I skipped out on taking a class all my public school friends had to take, life skills. At first, I was glad I missed out. Now that I'm a senior, I know I missed out on something important. Big financial choices are waiting for me around the corner. Credit card applications, paying for college, saving money. How do you decide when to splurge and when to save? My friends who took life skills said it forced them to talk to their parents about money. They had to create a budget, figure out what to spend, and how to allocate money. But I lucked out. My brother is 6 years older. He took the course, and he's my go-to person for finances. A couple of years ago, I opened a bank account. My brother went with me. He explained how it worked, how the banks make money from your money. He talked to my parents a lot about money. He knew about mortgages and taxes. When I would whine about getting the newest toy, he would take me aside and talk to me. He'd say, ask mom and dad about how much they have saved. Ask them about what they've spent to make sure that we have a good life. Soon, I learned about how they bought the house. They explained to me the long process that they had to go through to get a loan. Their biggest fear was getting scammed, so they read everything over and over again. They talked to me a lot about the process of credit checks, how they met with a banker and finally got a home loan for the house that I grew up in. Now I'm a senior at my charter school. My friends are graduating from public school this year, and when I ask them, they all agree that taking the life skills course was important. But they believe what I believe. Teaching about money should start at home. Kids learn by applying what they learn to real-life problems. What our parents are dealing with on a daily basis. Paying a mortgage, saving money for big purchases. I mean, it is life skills, right?
David Dominguez is a high school senior here in Los Angeles. Youth Radio produced his commentary. I'm not one of those people who's wanted to relive high school ever since I left it. Go Lions, I said, and bye-bye, as I walked out the doors of Westland High School for the last time in June of 1986. At least, I thought it would be the last time.
Later, Travis.
But about a month ago, I found myself back at West Lynn, about 15 miles south of downtown Portland, Oregon, wandering the corridors. Actually, I wasn't allowed to wander on account of the microphone in my hand, but I got a hall pass that entitled me to a turkey sandwich in the cafeteria and entry into Todd Jones's fifth period econ class.
Lexi? Okay. Joey?
Oh, my stars. 10 out of 27 gone. I'd say between field trip and swine flu, we're done. Girls, go ahead and move on up a row today. We don't need to be spread out.
Mr. Jones wanted his juniors and seniors closer to the front of the class so they could absorb the information from a special guest, which was not me. No, the day's guest was Melody Thompson, here to teach the students about insurance.
All right, you guys. We're here to talk about insurance. My experience working in insurance is I was a claims adjuster. A claims adjuster is the person that's going to be writing the checks.
Turns out West Lynn is one of the schools using curriculum from an Oregon nonprofit called Financial Beginnings to teach kids about money. Thompson founded the organization. It brings real-life experts into classrooms to teach high school kids about not just insurance, but credit cards, banking, car loans, anything related to personal finance.
So credit can actually affect your insurance rates. If you have poor credit, they're going to charge you more. Why?
It shows how responsible you are.
Yeah, the risk of whether you pay or not.
There's the responsibility, but actually, what was I saying before? On the actuaries. That's the
problem. Over the last few weeks, of course, we've been focusing on kids and money, how we teach it, what they think of it, all leading up to a special live show in Portland this Monday night. Most of us learn the basics of finance not from our parents, but at school. Back in my day, it was called home ec. It's where I learned how to balance a checkbook. Today's kids have probably never even heard of home ec. Thanks to budget cuts, they're not learning about budgeting. Unless they're lucky enough to have a teacher who thinks it just might be important. Enter Todd Jones. He dedicates several weeks of his econ class to topics around personal finance. So I sat down with him before class to talk about why. And I started by asking what his financial education looked like.
The only thing I remember distinctly about it was checkbook management. I remember them teaching us how to write checks and how to keep a check registry. And I still brag to my kids today that I do that. I actually bring my check registry in and put it up on the screen so they can look at it and they see how I enter and what I enter and why I enter it. But in my course, it's personal finance is much more expansive than that. Now, economics is not a required course at this high school. The students are required to get so many social studies credits, but they can choose from a number of things to fulfill that credit requirement. Economics is one of the choices.
What are the other choices?
Oh, anything from international relations to global events to modern European history.
So finance is an elective then?
It is. I personally think it should be a required course here. Now, that said, economics curriculum doesn't necessarily specifically call for personal finance in this state. You know, if you look at our textbook, it deals with the basics of, you know, how to run a business, supply and demand, macroeconomic concepts, et cetera. There really is no requirement in economics in the state that personal finance be done.
Why do you think it is that this subject is not part of the mandated curriculum nationwide?
I'm only speculating, both from things I've heard and things I've read, but as budgets got tighter, yet the expectations of core curriculum grew stronger. More and more schools are having to emphasize English, reading and writing, mathematics, sometimes science, and schools are saying, we're going to stick to the basics, and there are some things that families are going to have to take care of on their own. And so I think this has been left to parents to say, you've got to figure out how to educate your children financially.
And in general, do you believe that that's happening?
When I ask the students for feedback at the end of the semester on the course, they consistently tell me that this is some of the most important information they've gotten, because no one before has ever told them.
Including mom and dad.
Including. Yeah, the sources that we hope are taking care of that. They want to know how to manage their money. They want to be successful with it.
Hmm.
Now, whether they'll carry the lessons out of the room is another question. But they get it here.
Why do you think this isn't something that comes up in the home?
Like a lot of things, you know, a lot of parents are very busy with a lot of stuff. A lot of kids are very busy with a lot of stuff. And I think, for example, myself, when I sit down to do my bills or set my budget on the monthly basis, I usually do it after the kids have gone to bed. And I think parents just forget, you know, everything I do is a teaching opportunity for my own children. And I'll take myself as an example. I mean, I'm an economics teacher. And yet, it was only a few months ago that for the very first time, I was sitting down to do my bills, and I thought, duh. And I had my 12-year-old daughter come to me. I said, Ellie, sit down. I want to tell you what we spend our money on every month. You know, this is how much money mom and dad took in. Here's where the money goes. And notice how we have this budget set up, and notice how we pay savings first, and we pay our investments first, and our college savings, we pay that first. Why do we do that? Because if I leave it in the account, that money won't be there at the end of the month, because anything in the account will be spent.
And what was her reaction to that lesson?
Well, I think it was amazingly insightful to do it. I wish I had done it sooner, because what I have noticed is a change in her behavior in how she views our family's money now. Instead of viewing it as mom and dad's money and I want it, our money. And I'm finding that it even affects how often she asks for things, whether she asks for things. More and more we're asking her to contribute some of her own money to something if she wants it bad enough, so she really has to think to herself, do I want to fork out some of my own money? But I think she sees more of the big picture now and not just view mom and dad as this unending hole of source of cash.
Well, aren't you?
No. I teach public school.
So you have a 12-year-old daughter. How old is your other child?
At 10. I have two daughters, 12 and 10.
What do you think is an appropriate age to start talking about this kind of thing?
Oh, I think as soon as kids become aware of money, which is, what, 2, 3? As soon as they start saying, I want. I mean, or the lessons can start right there.
Sure.
You know, do you want that? Well, if we choose that, we might not get this. When you want to make a choice between the two things? I mean, literally, you are teaching your child an economic concept there. You're teaching them about scarcity. We have unlimited wants, but not limited resources. You're teaching them about opportunity cost. For everything I choose, there's something I can't choose. Those lessons are right there, and we should involve our kids in it.
What kind of lessons did you have as a kid? You talked a little bit about the class that you had in high school, but is it something that was talked about in your household?
No, not at all. Hmm. No, finances was something that just mom and dad need to take care of, and the rest of us just live our blissful youth. So.
Can you tell us what you're teaching this week?
We are mostly focused on credit cards this week. For example, I tell the students a little riddle, and I say, I think credit cards are absolutely frightening and scary, and yet I have one, and I use it at every single opportunity imaginable. And they look at me like, what? And what I explain to them later is, I use my credit card to pay for every single thing I can. And yet when I use it, I write it in my check registry as if it was a debit, as if the money's already spent. So I pay every bill in full every single month. I have not paid a penny of interest in the past 15 years. And yet, because I'm using the card, I'm accumulating all these points. So I say, if you're smart and disciplined enough to take advantage of the goodies without getting bit by the interest and the fees and the other things, then all power to you.
Todd Jones, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Teacher Todd Jones speaking with me at my alma mater, Westland High School in Oregon.
Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
It's time to answer your questions about life and money. And here with me to do that this week is Cheryl Harris. She's a consumer columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Cheryl, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Des.
How's Cleveland since we were there a couple months ago?
It's colder. Definitely colder.
Well, we're really glad you could join us again. And we've got some questions for you. You ready for those?
Sure thing.
All right. First, we've got Claudia on the phone in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there.
What's your question for us today?
Okay. I had to clean out a desk that we were getting rid of, and I was a little dismayed to realize how many years of bank statements and reports on retirement funds that I had been storing away because I wasn't quite sure what to do with them. I didn't want to just throw them in the trash. And now there are so many of them, they fill about half of a black trash bag. And and I know that they'll just burn out my little shredder in about 15 minutes. What do I do with all this stuff?
Well, first of all, how old is that desk that you're getting rid of?
The desk is probably about 75, 80 years old.
Oh, wow. Well, I hope you're donating it to an antique store then.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am.
Fabulous. So then how old are the papers inside the desk?
I think they're anywhere from about 4 to 8 years old.
All right. Well, okay. So Cheryl, these are very old papers, but I think isn't the IRS rule 7 years, at least for tax stuff?
You know, they say 3, but keep them 7 because they might come back longer. I always tend to err on the side of keeping things longer. So I think there are some things that you want to keep around, but you can't have things that go out into the trash with account numbers and other accessible kinds of information on them. I do the old-fashioned thing. I throw them in the fire as kindling. You know, when I'm going to start a fire in the fireplace.
I do the same. In fact, every New Year's Eve, one of the this will tell you how exciting my life is, but one of the things that my husband and I do is we build a fire and we go through all of our papers and toss out the stuff we don't need.
Now, you said that I need to keep things at least 7 years for IRS purposes. Is that correct?
Here's kind of the rule of thumb. Good things to keep long-term are insurance policies. You want to keep all your receipts for big-ticket items. You want to keep warranties and instruction manuals and maintenance or repair records for cars and appliances as long as you have them. You'd want to keep all the real estate records for your house. And I think keep tax records. And then, you know, the usual birth adoption records, deeds and wills, legal papers, life insurance policies, those kind of things.
Okay, fine.
Good question, Claudia.
Thank you.
Happy shredding.
Good luck.
Thanks for your help.
Cheryl, I think you and I have revealed our exciting personal lives. We spend shredding and burning our personal papers.
It's sad, Tess. It's really
sad. It is a
little
bit. Okay, New Year's resolution. Have a little more fun on New Year's Eve. All right, next we've got Wendy in Litchfield, Minnesota. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
How are you today?
Good. How are you guys?
Very well, thank you. Are you shredding anything right now?
I'm not, but I have in the past, though.
Okay, good enough. And how can we help you out?
I had a class I was signed up for in August, and I had canceled the class, actually before it started, and I got the invoice for it a month later. So they're saying that I still owe for that class, unless I can prove that I canceled it. And I'm going through my phone records trying to, you know, get the exact dates of when I canceled it.
And what's the school's policy for canceling? What do they say about how you can withdraw or cancel?
You could do it, you know, online or by phone, and you had up to a week after this particular class to cancel.
Since they're telling you that you can do it by phone, you know, they would have to keep track of the records of the calls that they get in order to, you know, make that stick. You know, they'd have to sort of prove that you didn't call.
Wendy, have you actually gone to campus to talk to somebody about this?
No, I haven't yet.
Yeah, it might be worth that, just a kind of an in-person look, folks. I made the call. I haven't been here, and you need to trust me. I mean, is that really what it's all about at this point, Cheryl?
I think a couple things. There are counselors at most schools, financial counselors. They're kind of a Sherpa for you as a student, and they can be extremely helpful in navigating the bureaucracy of any school. I also wonder if you shouldn't call your state's Office of Higher Education and see what policies they have in place, or if they have some protections for you, or a place that you can complain to if you can't work it out with a school. I agree that I think going to the school and trying to sort this out in person might be the best first step. But if you can't, then I might try that higher ed office as well.
Okay.
Wendy, is this something where you're enrolled at the school, or are you just taking a class going?
I was just enrolled as a casual student, just a class here and there.
I wonder, you don't have records or transcripts that you would need to have transferred to another school, or that you would need to have released from the school?
I possibly could later on, and that's why I was wondering, you know, if they're saying I owe it and then I don't pay it, you know, would I be able to transfer anything or take another class?
I would think you would want to get this settled before you take any more classes, because that is something where it could go into collections if you don't have some sort of conversation with them and figure this out. Right,
yeah,
Cheryl?
Debts have a bad way of growing. I mean, the amount of them grows. There's interest that goes along with them if you don't get this firmly settled at this moment.
So, Wendy, it sounds like maybe an in-person conversation is in order here.
Okay.
Or perhaps a registered letter.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Good luck.
Good All luck.
Right. If you've got questions about how to get your money back or keep it from getting away from you in the first place, you give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. There are lots of fun things to talk about when you're in a relationship. Money is not one of them.
People become really self-conscious about what people will interpret when they disclose their financial condition.
We'll talk about how to create financial intimacy coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've been exploring how to talk to kids about money, and by and large, we have found it is not easy. That shouldn't come as a surprise. Author and financial planner Jacquette Timmons says we can barely talk to other adults about money, especially the ones we're in relationships with. Timmons collected stories about money and love from all kinds of couples in her book Financial Intimacy. It aims to help people understand their own financial lives so they can better relate to a partner. But before we get to Jacquette, we thought we'd find some couples here in Los Angeles and ask how they deal with money. Ryan and Liz Miller provided us with one model.
Well, let's see. She tells me her financial plan, and I follow it as far as I'm interested to.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
We're saving for a house right now, so pretty much everything is just necessity.
Well, I mean,
we both work, and we, you know, share our bank accounts. And
we know how much each other makes. We know where the money goes. Also have the same goal, so
in, you know, getting to where you want to be, you kind of need to share that information.
I mean, everything else is shared. Sort of.
Newlyweds Quinette Santiago and Matt Murray have a slightly different approach.
I do most of the talking.
Yeah, I leave it everything up to him, actually, because I'm really bad at money, and he's a money guru, and we play to our strengths, I guess.
I'm the saver, she's the spender.
I think that I should probably be a little more responsible because I have an allowance.
Well, I'm not saying it's not uncomfortable sometimes or contentious, but
you know, when my allowance per se is a little tight, I kind of have my tantrums every now and then.
we have credit card arguments quite often, but that's the extent of it.
Jacquette Timmons, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk a little bit about this notion of financial intimacy. You know, today we earn a lot more money than we used to, as you point out in the book. But by and large, we don't manage our money any better, don't have much better financial security. Why is that?
Well, I think part of the reason is because as a culture, we do not talk very much about money, at least not in a substantive way. And so many of us have not really gotten a great deal of guidance with managing our money.
You know, I wonder why, and I've asked this of previous guests, but I'd like your take on why money is so much harder to talk about with our partners, our spouses, than just about anything else in our relationship.
Because I think it reveals a degree of vulnerability that perhaps other things do not. It defines your success to whatever degree. It defines the degree to which you make right choices. And so I think people become really self-conscious about what people will interpret when they disclose their financial condition or they disclose the choices that they've made and what the consequences of those choices have been. And so you feel very vulnerable.
And what is the best way to get over that? I mean, it's a lot easier said than done. It's not exactly romantic.
I actually think it really can be very romantic. And
okay, and one of please my, explain.
Well, one of my missions is to really use the whole notion of talking about money as the unlikely tool by which people can learn more about one another and as well grow together. One of the things that I recommend to some of my coaching clients that are couples, have a glass of wine every Friday night and talk about what happened this week financially. What do we need to be prepared for next week, next month? What's the long-term plan? I think the more frequently you have the conversation and the more frequently you have it in the context of something other than a heated argument about money, the easier it will be. But I think to answer your question more directly, we first have to begin to really understand what our own financial story is.
Well, when we think about our financial history, how do we figure out where our money habits came from? I mean, do we then have to talk to our parents as well as our partners and spouses?
It would be great if you could talk to your parents and have a better understanding of why they did some of the things that they did. But even if you can't speak with them directly for whatever the reason, you can actually just go back in memory and just think about what did you notice growing up? And then just really, you know, take that out further to explore and ask the question, well, how has that shaped me?
You know, up until a few decades ago, men pretty much managed the money. It was plain and simple. Then we women started getting jobs. We're living on our own now for a few years before getting married. I wonder, does any of that new independence seem to have made a difference in how we approach money management with our spouse or mate?
Absolutely. I mean, part of the challenge is many of us are delaying marriage and partnership. And therefore, when you come to the table, you come to the table with your own spending habits, with your own spending patterns, and a lot of, you know, things already entrenched. And now you've got to incorporate someone else, and they are coming to the table with their own routine as well. So yeah, it absolutely makes that part challenging.
You did more than a dozen case studies for this book. Anything shock or surprise you about how we manage our money with our mates?
No, you know, really nothing shocked me too much or, you know, made me go, oh my God. If anything, it was just really more of an affirmation that there are many women experiencing the same things, but again, because we tend not to talk about it, we don't know that our friend that we may consider our best friend is actually having the kinds of questions that she has about money in the context of her relationship because we don't talk about it. So I guess if there was one surprise that I could identify, it was just really a confirmation that we really have to begin to be less self-conscious and also just less judgmental when it comes to talking about money.
Jacquette Timmons is the author of Financial Intimacy. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're back to take more of your questions about life and money. And with me this week is Cheryl Harris. She's a consumer columnist with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And Cheryl, let's go to another caller. Colleen is on the phone in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Colleen.
Hi, Colleen. How are you?
What can we help you out with today?
I have been unemployed for 11 months. And less than a year ago, I was denied a job on the basis of my credit. Yeah.
Did you get a notice that said that? It said that you had been denied because of your credit report?
Yes. The under the FCRA, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, that requires an employer to notify you in writing of the fact that you've been denied.
Right, and
the
where the information came from.
Yes, they have to put that in the letter, what agency they ran the report from, and at that point you are entitled to a free copy of the report.
Right.
Did you get your report, and did you look at it, and is it correct?
No, my credit report contains a lot of misinformation on it.
Oh, it has errors?
Yes, it does.
And did you send back a letter to the credit reporting agency pointing out the errors and requesting that it be fixed?
I did. That is a complicated process, and as you know, there
yes,
are...
Yes, it is.
Yeah. It almost requires the hiring of an attorney.
I think that maybe your sensibility here, that this is not fair and you'd like to lobby for this in some way, I think that's perfectly acceptable. And, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to really mess up your credit report. All it takes is a job loss or a major illness. And these credit reports, they're not really meant as an indicator of how you'll perform on a job. They're meant as an indicator to financial institutions about whether you're a good risk to assume more credit.
Cheryl, is this an instance where perhaps it would be appropriate for Colleen to call up the potential employer and see if she can have a discussion about this, talk about how she's trying to work with the credit bureaus to correct this information?
Well, there's a bill that's in the House right now, the U.S. House, and that would prohibit most employers from using credit reports for pre-employment screening. I mean, it takes a long time for anything to happen legislatively.
Right.
So in the short run, if you can see someone in person, if you can network, if you can say, you know, hi, this is who I am, and mention, you know, obliquely without spending a lot of time, you know, I was out of a job. There are some things on my credit report that are wrong. I'm trying to deal with that right now. But I'd be a good employee for you because of XYZ. If you can sort of frame it in your way, I think... Two, that if you are having difficulty with your credit report and there are errors, there are two places to go where you can get help resolving those. First of all, I would report it to the Federal Trade Commission because while they don't look at individual complaints, they do enforce the FCRA. And the other thing is I would contact your own state attorney general because in my state, they're pretty effective at getting problems cleared up on credit reports.
So, Colleen, there are a couple of steps that you can take, even though you've tried your hardest at this point, but maybe it's time to call in bigger guns.
Yeah, I will take that under advisement.
All right, Colleen, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks, Colleen.
Bye-bye.
Good luck.
Let's go next to Nick in Redondo Beach, California. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What's your question for us today?
My wife and I have been saving for multiple years to take a six-month world trip, and where we would love to take this trip, you know, with a poor economy, is this just a foolish, conspicuous consumption?
Well, first of all, tell us where you want to go.
Well, it's a round-the-world trip, so we'll probably head to Asia, Africa, Europe a little bit.
Well, Cheryl, my immediate reaction is go for it. But
mine
I suppose
too.
There are more questions
agree.
To ask.
Okay, so if this is a dream, then why are you calling to ask if you should go?
Well, you know, we would love to take this trip, but, you know, is this something that could put us in financial peril or, you know, is this just a small calculated risk?
Well, that really depends on your personal financial situation. Without giving us all the details, do you have savings? Do you have a job?
I do have a job. You know, to take the world trip, my wife would have to quit her job.
And how is she feeling about that?
She's fine with it. I mean, it was her idea to take the world trip in the first place, but I would be able to take a leave of absence and come back to the same job. But when we come back, I do make most of the income, so we could actually live indefinitely off of the amount. We also have been saving. We estimate that the trip will cost about $30,000, but we'll have about $40,000 saved up.
So you'd come back with $10,000 in the bank.
Well, you know, estimates are never
right,
that great.
Sure. What do you think, Cheryl, just with that kind of top line look at their finances?
Oh, well, I'm just curious about your industry and how recession proof you think that is, and just the idea of letting your company know that they can live without you for 6 months. are you okay with that? Do you think?
Yeah, actually, I'm pretty fortunate in that I work in what's called the Federally Funded Research and Development Center, which is low risk of having a severe downturn, and also it's relatively low risk of losing my job should I take a leave of absence.
Well, what I think is, what kind of people are you and your wife going to be if you have a chance to follow a dream and do something as romantic as travel around the world together for an extended period of time and then choose not to do it? I mean, I really wonder how that could crimp your relationship going forward. I mean, do you plan to have kids?
No, we don't. We don't have children. We are not planning on it.
Oh, well, that's good, because once you have children, you can never travel at all.
No.
So, really.
Oh, no, Cheryl, that's just sad.
Oh, it is sad, but I'm parked at home cutting up my old paperwork, Tess. But, well, I don't know. I think if you've saved for it, I mean, you've got this little cushion. You're pretty sure of your job security. I mean, it sounds to me like you guys have put a lot of planning and thought into this. I mean, follow your dream.
Great.
What do you think, Tess?
Yeah, Nick, I think you got a green light there.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
And you know, on top of it all, you're supporting the world economy.
Thanks.
There you go.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Hey, have a great trip.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Bye-bye. Oh, Cheryl, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got.
Well,
it
was very fun.
Well, you can give us a call with your questions. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And, of course, you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Cheryl, so nice to talk to you again, and we'll look forward to chatting again with more questions. Great advice. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Tess. I enjoyed it.
Marketplace Money is supported by The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So as we head into our final countdown before our live show in Portland on Monday, we've been asking you, our listeners, for your stories about childhood and money. What your parents taught you or didn't. What you're teaching your kids or not. This week, a retired dad and his adult daughter remember what he taught her about money when she was a kid and what sticks with her today.
I'm Curtis Larson. I'm from Hudson, Wisconsin. I have three daughters.
My name is Erin Anderson. I'm the eldest.
We wanted to make certain that they had dollars that they could spend with their own free will. In first grade, they got about a dollar per person per week. And in second grade, $2. And in sixth grade, like $6. And I was looking at my, believe this or not, my records, which are on index cards. As I look at my little card here, I see that in 1984, Erin got about a dollar a week. But at that point, she was required to, what was it, Erin?
Like 25 cents to the church or to share, 25 to spend, and then the 50 cents to save. I remember every Sunday we got to go into Dad's drawer, the drawer, and he had a butter dish full of coins, and we got to pick out our coins every week. The drawer was always a sacred place that you just, even today, you still got the butter dish with the coins.
To be perfectly honest, it helped make it easier. At the same time, I think it instilled trust to let them take their own allowance. And then the toughest part for me, being a practical guy, was to let them take their spending money and spend it on whatever they wanted to spend it on. If it was a little blow pinwheel or cotton candy or
the candy bar, the gum at the grocery store, as mom was paying for all the groceries.
My wife and I really worked together on that very well to say, no, let them do it. This is the way they learn. We never took the allowance away from our daughters for not doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Allowance was a privilege they got for being a member of our family. And so I never said, if you don't do that, you're not going to get your allowance. I would go and try to put myself in their shoes. What would I do if my employer was to take my pay away from me because they didn't like what I did for 1 week, even if I was trying hard, you know? A kid's job is to explore and experiment, you know, and they're going to make a lot of mistakes. You need to encourage it and know that you're still an okay kid.
It wasn't a reward or a punishment system. And I think that maybe helps me even today with money to not look at it as a reward or a punishment. And how can you use it responsibly, I guess, and not emotionally?
Manamana.
Curtis Larson and Erin Anderson talking about childhood and money.
We want your stories and your questions. Find the link to submit them at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we are live from Portland with local families, experts, and Oompa Loompas talking about how to teach kids about money. We'll also be joined by special guests Mike Richardson, the founder of Dark Horse Comics, and Chris Walla of Death Cab for Cutie. Chris, you any good with your money?
I'm getting better. I have a 401k. I'm selling CDs like crazy.
Sounds good to me. We'll see you Monday. Tune in for an hour of kids, parents, and piggy banks. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Jolie Myers. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.